Okay, this is Brian Flanahan again, and we're going to pick up with the 1856 election. In the last presentation, we talked about the early 1850s, and of course, the Pierce administration, and also the 1848 election, and the Zachary Taylor and Millard Fillmore administrations. And we talked about how the sectional conflict is brewing in this time, kind of bubbling to the surface again, primarily because we've acquired a tremendous amount of territory. And that territory, of course, is going to lead to controversy over who's going to organize the territory, who's going to have access to the territory. And so one historian, again, has labeled this particular time period in American history the blundering generation. These people don't know what they're doing. They're agitating a question that had been settled before, and it was unnecessary. In fact, I mean, as we move forward, I think one thing you're going to start thinking about, or you need to start thinking about, is how unnecessary the war actually was in 1861 in so many ways. Wasn't that the South, of course, didn't have grievances that were legitimate, or the North didn't have grievances that were legitimate. But the fact is, did that war even need to come about in the first place? Could it have been avoided? I think that's a question that we're going to answer, and I think we're going to answer it in the affirmative. It could have been avoided if this blundering generation had been a little more perceptive, and most importantly, if we didn't have a purely sectional party in the United States. For a long time, you had a situation where you had a national party with the Democrat Party. They had supporters in both the North and the South. And you had a national party in the Whig Party. They had supporters in the North and the South. Once that breaks apart, you no longer have that situation. And of course, that's going to lead to tremendous conflict, because one section or the other will be able to say that it's, again, it's the one section being aggressive or the other section being aggressive. Now, if you look at those two claims, and we talked about this in the last presentation again, you have the North saying it's the slave power and the South saying it's Northern aggression. I think if you look at it objectively, you're going to see that the South actually had a stronger case than the North. And we've talked about that. Of course, there were Southerners who were interested in expansion, but for the most part, their most ardent defender of slavery, John C. Calhoun, was saying, let's not expand. We don't need to expand. You did have expansionists in the cabinet and the Pierce administration, namely Jefferson Davis, who wanted to acquire the Gadsden Purchase, which they did, to get a transcontinental line. But it was no different than the North looking at it for the same exact reason. We want a transcontinental line, so that's why Stephen Douglas wanted to organize the Kansas and Nebraska territories under popular sovereignty. The guy's going to make a lot of money, and he wants that transcontinental line. He owns land that he thinks is going to shoot right through. So it's no different. But what you can say is that the North was starting to take a little different stance, one that they had never taken before, in that they were going to try to bottle up the South and make it to where there would be essentially no more Southern control of the government. And the South, of course, had long controlled the government. So the North is going, and if you look at, go all the way back to, say, the Hartford Convention, and look at the things that they wanted to do in 1814, 1815. I mean, one of the things was abolishing the three-fifths compromise of the Constitution. Why? Because that gave the South power. Or requiring a two-thirds majority to admit new states. Why? Because they believed that these new states would vote with the South. Now, what they've done is created an alliance with the West and themselves, and that has marginalized the South. And again, they're using that rhetorical issue of slavery. We know you don't like slavery, not because you worry about the plight of slaves, but because you don't want them in your territory and you don't want the competition, whether it's from free blacks or slaves, in places like the old Northwest Territory or what will become Kansas, Nebraska, the Dakotas, that particular area. So, again, this rhetorical issue is heating up. It's not a moral issue for most Americans. It's a rhetorical issue. And again, the South's stance was probably a little more justified in that they did believe that North is the northern section, particularly what my advisor in graduate school called the Deep North, New England. I mean, we always say it's the Deep South. What about the Deep North? What do you call the Deep North? New England being fairly aggressive here. I mean, if you have somebody from Massachusetts, Charles Sumner, essentially saying Southerners are vomit, drunken vomit, well, how's that going to work out in healing these differences between the sections? It's not. So I think as we move forward here, again, oftentimes the southern position is a little more accurate than the northern. Now, let's talk about this 1856 election. Franklin Pierce is not going to run again. In fact, the guy has a miserable life. His wife has died. All his children have died. In fact, he witnessed his last child die in a railroad accident just before he was inaugurated. And so the guy's essentially become a miserable drunk. And that's what's going to happen. Once he leaves the executive mansion, he said, and literally said, all I have now to do is drink. And that's what he did. He drank and drank and drank. So he's out. Now, the Democrats are going to, again, dust off the old playbook. Hey, all right, we've won now in 52 with a Northerner. So we need to get this another Northerner back in office. It almost worked in 48, but of course they were going up against a great war hero in Zachary Taylor. But let's think about another Northerner. Now, there's a very loyal Democrat, a guy that had been in the Democrat Party for a long time, had been Secretary of State, had a very good reputation, and that's James Buchanan. And James Buchanan is going to get the nomination in 1856 for the Democrat Party. Now, he supports popular sovereignty, so that appeals to the South, at least at this point. Later on, it's not going to, necessarily, particularly after the Dred Scott decision, which we'll talk about in this presentation. But he supports popular sovereignty. He supports Southern rights in the territory, so he's going to get the Southern vote. He's also favors all the traditional Democrat positions, you know, low tariffs, a independent treasury, et cetera, et cetera. No federally funded internal improvements. So Buchanan's going to be the guy. Now, that said, the Whig Party is gone in 1856. There's no more Whig Party. It is split up, broken up. We talked about the formation of the Republican Party. In 1856 is going to be the first year that the Republicans run a candidate for president. And who do they nominate? That guy that wanted to be president of California back during the Mexican War, John Charles Fremont. In fact, their slogan is pretty interesting. It's free speech, free press, free soil, free men, Fremont, and victory. It's catchy. And of course, that's, you know, we're starting to talk about image now. But again, this is a purely sectional party. Fremont isn't even on the ballot in many parts of the United States, mainly the South, because they're not going to put him on the ballot. There is going to be another party in this election, the American Party. We often call them the Know-Nothings. And the American Party are kind of these conservative Whigs that have gotten together. You know, these guys may not want to be Republicans. There are some Democrats that have joined the American Party. And in fact, they're going to have some fairly good success in 1854 and 1856 as the Whig Party just blows apart following the Kansas-Nebraska Act. And the Whig Party, of course, is called the Know-Nothing Party. You know, I know nothing but my country and my whole country and nothing but my country. I mean, this is the kind of thing that they said. They also had secret meetings. You know, essentially the American Party kind of had a Whiggish position, the Northern Whiggish position on the economy, more of a Hamiltonian system. They also were anti-immigrant, and so they're going to play up on that particular issue. By the 1850s, you have a large number of Irish and German immigrants coming into the United States, and so that's going to be a popular issue. And so, you know, this American Party is going to get some votes. In fact, they nominate a former president, Millard Fillmore. Of course, the president from 1850 to 1853, he's going to be their guy in 1856. This is going to be a very close election. And Buchanan's going to win primarily because, of course, Fremont can't get any votes in the South. The American Party doesn't have a whole lot of support, except mainly in the mid-Atlantic region of the United States. And, of course, Buchanan's going to have votes all over the United States. He's going to get northern votes, southern votes, western votes. So the Democrat Party, being the truly national party at this time, is going to win the election. And there's a lot of stuff going on here. Okay, so the 1850s and the Buchanan administration, I mean, this is it. This is the last time period that we have before we get the sectional conflict boil over into a hot war with the war between the states. And, of course, it's during the Buchanan administration that we're going to be talking about secession. Now, that's actually going to be in the next presentation. I deal with secession by itself in the 1860 election, and I talk about other issues going on there. For example, the formation of the Confederate States of America. But Buchanan, again, he's one of these guys, kind of like Pierce. You know, he's seen as an inept president. One of the worst in American history. In fact, if you look at a list, again, these lists of historians put out there, who is the greatest president, and who's number one, who's number two, who's number three, four, five. Buchanan usually is down near the bottom in the 40s, if not dead last. And why is he considered dead last? Because this is the guy that lost the Union. Now, we have to seriously think about that. This is the guy that lost the Union. He didn't lose the Union. I think the guy that lost the Union was Abraham Lincoln. Buchanan didn't lose the Union. Of course, secession started during his administration. And by the end of his administration, there were 7 states out of the Union. But Buchanan didn't lose it. He still had a Union. He still had the Union, except for 7 states. And the question has to be, well, what's the big deal in reality? Why is it important to save those 7 states in the Union? For years, Northerners had talked about secession. For years, they had wanted the South out, or at least wanted to marginalize the South. So what's going on here? Buchanan was saving the Union, minus 7 states. It was Abraham Lincoln and Abraham Lincoln's actions after he became president that forced the rest of the states out of the Union and brought us into a hot war. Buchanan should not be considered a bad president. In fact, he was doing everything he could, in his mind, to save the Union. So this guy, again, was following his presidential powers. He was doing what he could to make sure that the executive branch was being adhered to correctly. So he did save the Union. Now, one of the most important cases in Supreme Court cases in American history takes place during the Buchanan administration. And again, this is one of those things that's often seen as Buchanan being rather obnoxious. And it's the Dred Scott v. Sanford case. Now, let's put all this in perspective. We've had this sectional conflict now since that Mexican session really bubbling over. Here it is, 1857. Since the Mexican session, actually going back to the Wilmot Proviso in 1846. Since 1846, for the last 11 years, we've had a major crisis in the United States over organizing this new Mexican territory. And we've had the Kansas-Nebraska Act. We've had the Compromise of 1850. We've had popular sovereignty thrown around. We've had bleeding, quote-unquote, bleeding Kansas, as the Republicans called it. Again, not a whole lot of violence there, except for the homicide committed by John Brown. We've had some serious issues. And so when Buchanan gets in office, he thinks to himself, okay, I've got to do something here to try to solve this issue. Now, the Supreme Court Chief Justice in 1857 was a man named Taney. And Taney was from Maryland. Taney actually is an interesting character. He was actually the Secretary of the Treasury during the Andrew Jackson administration. And here's a guy that was responsible for pulling all the U.S. deposits out of the Bank of the United States and putting them in pet banks. He was the guy that Jackson finally got that would do it. A lot of guys wouldn't do this, but Taney was willing to do it. So Roger Taney of Maryland is the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And there's a theory out there, there was some type of conspiracy here. These two guys got together and decided to settle the issue. I think there was some discussion between the two of them. And again, the important thing about this case, this is very interesting. This is the first time since the early 19th century that the Supreme Court is going to declare a federal law unconstitutional. It hadn't happened since the Marshall administration. And so here you have a situation where the South is actually going to favor something they had never favored before. In fact, John Marshall, when he was out there essentially legislating from the bench, was really riling up Southerners. They were saying, you can't do this, particularly the Jeffersonians. You can't do this. But when Taney does it, I think the perception is in the South, well, this is something that finally puts to bed this sectional conflict. And what Buchanan is trying to do here, of course, is solve the problem. And he did have some discussions with Taney again about this. He's trying to solve the problem, trying to put it to bed, trying to put this thing to rest. What he's going to do and what this decision is going to do is only incite more hatred towards the South and just ramp up that slave power rhetorical charge over and over again. So it doesn't really solve anything. In fact, it creates more problems. Now, Chief Justice Roger Taney is going to hear a case involving, and of course the Supreme Court is going to hear a case involving a man named Dred Scott. Now, Dred Scott was a slave in Missouri. And interestingly enough, Dred Scott was actually taken into free territory and then brought back into Missouri. And they live in this free territory for a time now by his owner. Now, what Scott is going to do is he's going to sue for his freedom in federal court. Now, this is interesting. There are a number of issues at stake here. First of all, can a slave sue in federal court? If a slave is not a citizen, then no. And that's going to be one of the issues that's going to be decided by the decision. So that's first and foremost. The other thing is, the underlying question is, if a slave is brought into free territory, does that make that person free? And so that's going to be decided by this particular decision, by this Dred Scott v. Sanford. And, of course, Taney's even going to go further in this, okay? And I'm going to talk about that in a second. Now, Scott had actually sued in Missouri in federal court. And the case was appealed all the way up the line because he actually won in one level, lost in another. So they appealed it up to the Supreme Court. And he had a lot of financial backing here from some of your most famous abolitionists and some people in the North who are really looking at this case as a benchmark. And they want, it was a test case. I mean, what can they get through the Supreme Court? What will the Supreme Court do? Well, Taney and again, Buchanan think that this is the issue. This is the time. They need to put this thing to bed. So Taney is going to first and foremost rule that he really has no jurisdiction in this because Dred Scott is a slave. He's not a citizen and therefore he cannot sue in federal court. So the case should have been dismissed right there. He has no standing essentially to rule on the particular case. The case has no standing in federal court. But Taney is going to go further. He could have stopped right there and said, look, this issue is dead. But he's going to go further. And this is what's really going to irritate people. Again, this is the first time since 1803 that the Supreme Court has declared a federal law unconstitutional. And here is what happens. Taney is going to say that not only is Scott not a citizen, and therefore he can't sue in federal court, he's going to declare the Missouri Compromise and the Compromise of 1850, and essentially the Kansas-Nebraska Act, unconstitutional. He's going to say, look, because of the Fifth Amendment to the Constitution, you cannot deny slaveholders their property in the territories because by doing so, you're denying them their property without due process. So he is essentially now codifying the fact that the argument Southerners have been making is now upheld. That you cannot deny them their property. Congress can pass no law that denies them their property, in essence, equal access to the territories, because it abridges their Fifth Amendment rights to the Constitution. So, he makes this legal. He says, Congress, if you do this, you're violating the law. And, of course, James Buchanan is supporting it. So, if Congress passes any legislation which does so, Buchanan, of course, will immediately veto it. He essentially voids the Missouri Compromise. Now, that's not a big deal, really, because the Missouri Compromise had already been voided by the Kansas-Nebraska Act and the Compromise of 1850, essentially. But he's saying not only is the Missouri Compromise unconstitutional, the Compromise of 1850 and the Kansas-Nebraska Act, because you can pick either or. He's saying, no, it's completely open. The territories are completely open to slaveholders. You can't say, even a territorial legislature cannot say that you can't bring your slaves into this territory. Well, to Southerners, this is a supreme victory. They've been vindicated. All the things they've been saying for years are now true. To Northerners, this is the slave power run amok. They control the executive branch, even though, of course, Buchanan's from Pennsylvania. They control the Supreme Court. Taney's from Maryland. And in fact, Taney was an abolitionist, so he really wasn't interested in slavery. That's what makes all this so funny. The Northerners are saying, oh my gosh, the slave power is at work here. We've got this dough face, that's what they call these Northerners. We've got this dough face that support the South. Dough face in the executive branch, now he's just ruled for the South. We've got this guy in the Supreme Court, he's just a slave power abolitionist. How's that work out? So we've got two guys that really had no vested interest in slavery whatsoever, Buchanan and Taney, in this particular decision, codifying, making law, essentially, what Southerners have been saying for years. Northerners are not going to be too happy with this thing, and they are really going to incite some resistance to it. In fact, what's interesting about this, Southerners start, championing this thing. The issue's dead. The issue's dead. I mean, they can't say anything about it anymore. The issue's dead. The man that I wrote my dissertation on, James A. Byard of Delaware, his son was a Democrat, very interested in this. Of course, the Byards didn't own slaves either. His son essentially wrote him a letter saying, you know, Dad, this issue now is dead. And Byard was very perceptive. James Byard, the younger, his father. He said, no. He said, unfortunately, I don't think it is. He said, these fanatics in the North are going to keep pushing this issue, even though the Supreme Court now has said that the issue is dead. You can't regulate slavery in the territories. In fact, this is when popular sovereignty essentially will die for most Democrats. Not all, but for most. Because they're going to say the issue is dead. I mean, the Supreme Court has said we can't use popular sovereignty anymore. If you support it, they really start dusting off this squatter sovereignty rhetoric that they had used before. But now they're saying you definitely can't use popular sovereignty. But Byard said, no, the issue is not dead. It's not going to die. Northerners will not let it die. So he was very perceptive. I think other Democrats believed that the North would have to abide by this decision and that the issue would be dead. Now, what's going to happen here, and I mentioned Kansas before, in the Republicans called Bleeding Kansas. I mentioned in that particular presentation that for years, Southerners had actually supported the position that the territory should be open to slavery. But now, once it's a state, they can do what they want. And Calhoun had made arguments to that effect, for example, in the admission of Michigan. Once a state was a state, they were equal sisters with the other states. They could prohibit slavery if they wanted to, but territories were different. Territories were different. And Northerners, though, had never really followed that position. They wanted to regulate the territories and regulate slavery in the territories, but they had never accepted that once a state was a state, it could have slavery if it wanted in the Western territories. They had never really accepted that position. They were all for free states in the Western territories. And again, this goes back to Missouri. They didn't want Missouri to come in as a state. Even though the people of Missouri decided that they were going to be a slaveholding state, they didn't want that. They didn't want it at all. Southerners were never really interested in blocking states from coming in the Union as free states if that's what the people wanted. Now, I know there's exceptions to this. But Southerners had been a little more agreeable to this position that states are states, they can do what they want. If Massachusetts wants to abolish slavery, they can. But if, you know, South Carolina wants to keep it, they can too. And if a state in the West wants to come in as a slave state, they should be able to do that too. So this is all going to come to a head with Kansas in 1857 through something called the Lecompton Constitution. The people of Kansas are going to form a territorial legislature, and they are going to adopt a constitution called the Lecompton Constitution. This is an interesting issue because the Lecompton Constitution actually had two different versions. One would have made slavery a permanent institution. The other kind of would have made slavery an institution that could have died out. They would have accepted slave rights for people that are already there, but the issue would have died out after that. Essentially, Kansas would have only been a slave state for a limited time. There was an option out there. It was on the ballot. Okay, people could have voted either way. Well, for some reason, the Free Soil Forces in Kansas decide not to vote in this election. And so the Lecompton Constitution, the constitutional convention that had been put together was done through a legal process, and it was a fair election. They put together this pro-slavery constitution, and then they put it up to the vote of the people in a referendum. Well, none of these free soil people vote in the referendum for some reason. And the issue, there are two possible scenarios here. Perhaps they wanted to keep the slavery issue alive and help Republicans, because if they did this, of course, if they could keep this issue alive in Kansas, well, that's going to give the Republicans some rhetorical fire here. Well, here it is, a slave power in Kansas again. They're trying to get this pro-slavery constitution, et cetera, et cetera. But the other reason that they may not have voted for this thing is because the Lecompton Constitution also contains some things these people didn't like. Political economy. There are some issues here with voting districts, with taxes, with promotion of industry, things like that. So there were some issues in this Constitution that these free soil forces, and remember, these are all the old Whigs coming into Kansas through the New England Immigrant Aid Society. So there are some issues here in this Constitution outside of slavery. Slavery could have died in Kansas if they had adopted the second choice in this Constitution, but they refused to even vote. So now the Lecompton Constitution has been ratified by the people of Kansas, and it goes to Congress. So now Congress has to decide if Kansas is going to come into the Union. So Congress has an opportunity here to say, okay, we're going to admit Kansas as a slave state, because that's what would have happened. Now remember, the people of Kansas and a constitutional convention have ratified, and then through a referendum, have ratified a pro-slavery constitution. But what happens is Northerners in Congress are going to say, no, 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 we can't support this constitution because no Northerners voted for it. Well, what does that matter? They had a choice to go vote in the election. They chose not to. They chose not to participate in the referendum. They chose not to participate in selecting the second choice. They could have essentially gotten rid of Kansas, slavery in Kansas over time. They chose not to do so. So they didn't participate on their own free will. This was not a rigged election. This was not an election where Northerners were told to stay home by force, by bayonet. They could have come out and participated, but they chose not to. The Constitutional Convention was legally put together by the military, essentially the military governor of Kansas, and by the people of Kansas. So these Northerners could have participated. They chose not to. And that was the argument Democrats were using. Wait a second here. You know, we put together this Constitution legally. Now you're saying you won't even let us do that. You won't even let us put together a Constitution and vote on it. We've always supported, for example, we supported Michigan coming in as a free state. We supported Ohio and Indiana and Illinois coming into the Union as a free state. What's the rub here? You won't let us have anything. So again, Southerners had a little better argument here, that Northerners were being aggressive at all times and trying to prevent slave states from coming into the Union. And again, the fear was political economy. They don't want the South to continue to have this role in dominating the government. They can't stand it. And so they're going to do everything they can to block it time and time and time again. Now, Buchanan will support the Lecompton Constitution. He says, here it is. Now, what's going to happen is very interesting. After this thing gets put to Congress, there's going to be another vote in Kansas. This time, the Free Soil Forces decide they're going to come out and vote. And what they do is, now it's not we have two different versions of the Constitution to vote for. It's an up or down. We're going to either be pro-slavery or not, have a pro-slavery constitution or not. Doesn't even mean if it's a mild pro-slavery constitution that would recognize the rights of slaveholders already in that state, what would be a state, and then eventually say no more after that. We're just going to vote it down, up or down, on slavery being in Kansas at all. And so now the Free Soil Forces are going to come out in crushing majorities, and the pro-slavery forces are going to boycott the election because they say, we've already got a constitution. You decided not to participate. Why not? You should have participated the first time. This thing has already been put to Congress. You can't do this. You can't vote a constitution that's already up or down, that's already been sent to Congress. And legally, they were right. But Northerners are going to say, no, no, no. They've had another vote, and that vote said, we don't want this pro-slavery constitution. So now which one are they going to accept? This is how ridiculous it gets. This is how ridiculous the whole situation is to Southerners who are saying, my gosh, we have no chance now. They won't even let us get a state into the Union, a mild pro-slavery state. Not even one that, you know, has pro-slavery forever. This could be a situation. Now, the Lecompton Constitution, of course, recognized slavery perpetually, but they even had another choice, that if Free Soil Forces really wanted it, they could have gotten rid of slavery gradually in Kansas. They don't even vote for that. So this is how ridiculous Southerners are saying this thing is getting. We can't even get a state in the Union. We're done. We're basically done. We're done with this government. Secession now is going to start being talked about very openly in the South again. We're done with this thing. The North is just going to continue being aggressive. Now, on the other side, Northerners are saying, well, here it is, the slave power again. They're involved in Kansas. They've got this pro-slavery constitution. You've got their puppet up in the White House, James Buchanan. Here's a guy supporting slavery, even though we voted that constitution down. But again, legally, their position was a little bit tenuous. They already had a constitution that was voted on by the people, a constitutional convention that was put together by the people. It wasn't like the Free Soil Forces were excluded. Now, this is actually going to lead to a very interesting situation in 1858. You have a senatorial race in Illinois. And, of course, one of the candidates is going to be Stephen Douglas, the guy who was the architect of the Kansas-Nebraska Act and a fervent supporter of popular sovereignty. Excuse me. The other guy is going to be Abraham Lincoln. Now, this is the first time Abraham Lincoln really had a national stage, so to speak. Lincoln had been in Congress before, but he really did nothing. I mean, his record in Congress and the House of Representatives is spotty. The guy was a do-nothing representative, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. I think sometimes we think that a person needs to go to Washington and do something all the time, writing legislation, acting like they need to pass something. Perhaps we need people who aren't interested in that all the time. But Lincoln really didn't have much of a record other than being the most ardent defender of big business in Illinois, in the court system of Illinois. He was a lawyer. His house was had the finest house in Springfield, right across from the courthouse, so he could go and represent big business over and over again. And that's what he always did. I mean, Lincoln was a Whig to the core in terms of his political economy. So he's going to be running for Senate in 1858 against Stephen Douglas. And these two are going to have a series of debates called the Lincoln-Douglas debates. They're often quoted because what you're looking at here is a snapshot of Lincoln's views on a number of issues. Slavery extension, race, I mean, all these things are brought out in this particular series of debates. It's also important because what happens in these debates is that Stephen Douglas will destroy his chances of becoming president in 1860. And that's because he's going to go back on the Dred Scott decision. So these debates will bring Lincoln to prominence. I mean, this is where the guy really makes a name for himself and where Republicans start to think of this guy as a viable candidate in 1860. Lincoln is kind of a Southerner, he's from Kentucky originally. He's got his wife, his family is a Southern family. They're slaveholders. He's got kind of this, Western background, kind of like Henry Clay. You know, they think, well, maybe this guy would be agreeable. He's not a real ardent abolitionist. In fact, he says during these debates, that he believes white people are superior. I mean, that's generally the consensus in the United States in the 19th century. That he really doesn't care if the South keeps slavery, but he just doesn't want to see it extended. So Lincoln is kind of seen as a moderate. He's seen as not a guy like one of these radical abolitionists up in New England, but a guy who could appeal to more than just New Englanders or abolitionists in an election. You know, John Fremont was a little bit more of a radical. Lincoln's more of a moderate. Now, Douglas, though, again, is going to destroy his chances of becoming president because of something called the Freeport Doctrine. Now, the Freeport Doctrine is essentially Douglas saying that I don't care about the Dred Scott decision. I don't care what the Supreme Court said. I don't care about any of that. I still believe in popular sovereignty. And so I'm still going to push popular sovereignty. He's still going to push popular sovereignty against the will of the South, against the will of the Supreme Court. And Southerners pick up on this, and they start hammering Stephen Douglas. There's no way they're going to support this guy in 1860. But, of course, he is the front runner for president. He thought the Kansas-Nebraska Act would get him the presidency either in 56 or 60. He tried in 56, was knocked down by James Buchanan. He's going to try again in 60. So he thinks this is his chance. Now, 1860... to become president. He's going to be sorely mistaken. Again, because he supports popular sovereignty. And Southerners, by 58, had said, enough with popular sovereignty. The Supreme Court's already said, we can bring our slaves into the territory. You cannot deny us our property because of the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution. Now, Lincoln also made a very famous speech here called the House Divided Speech in 1858. And, of course, the gist of it, I've linked it in the PowerPoint presentation, but a house divided against itself cannot stand. The union has to either be all free or all slave. Again, Seward is going to make William H. Seward is going to make a similar case. But, you know, we can't be divided here. We can't have a divided union. And, of course, people are going to pick up on this thing. My gosh, what are you saying here? You know, this is going to lead to war if we keep this position up. We can't say that. So is Lincoln being entirely accurate here? Is he being truthful? Is Lincoln inciting a problem here? And I think that overall, what you have to look at in Lincoln is that this guy really wasn't interested in saving the Union. He was interested in recreating the Union. And that, when I'll talk about that when we get to Reconstruction, but he's not interested in saving the Union like James Buchanan was. He's interested in recreating the Union and creating something new. Now, it's also during the Buchanan administration that we're going to get John Brown's raid. Now, John Brown, the homicidal maniac who slaughtered people in Kansas, in the Bleeding Kansas episode, now is going to be involved in another massacre, so to speak, in 1859. Now, he's been funded by a group of men called the Secret Six. And the Secret Six has ties to some of the most prominent abolitionists in New England. These are not people that are just run-of-the-mill people. They are influential people in New England. And they're going to be funneling money into John Brown for what they don't know, but John Brown has an idea of what he wants to do, and he wants to have a slave republic. And how is he going to do that? He's going to incite slave rebellion. Now, it's going to focus initially on Harper's Ferry, Virginia. There's an armory in Harper's Ferry, Virginia. And this particular armory is essential because he wants to get weapons into the hands of slaves. So he actually sets up in a barn. He puts his headquarters in a barn and starts to formulate his plans while he's getting money from these Secret Six. And he starts acquiring weapons and a few followers. Not many. I mean, you're talking about less than two dozen, really. And he starts getting these people together. And the idea was that they're going to storm this federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry, confiscate these weapons, get them into the hands of slaves, and then they're going to incite a slave rebellion in Virginia. Little problem here. When John Brown does this in 1859, he will assault the arsenal at Harper's Ferry, but no slaves come to his aid. Not one. In fact, the first person killed is a black guy. Kind of hard to have a slave rebellion with no slaves. And when you're killing black people, that makes it a little worse. So John Brown's attempt at his slave republic fails miserably. I mean, this is a disaster for him. He's actually wounded in this particular event. The Virginia militia is going to come in, and they're going to arrest John Brown. He's going to be put on trial for treason against the United States. Now, this is going to be important, not because John Brown failed. I mean, it's a disaster. It's laughable, really, what happens here with that situation. You know, John Brown thinking he's going to have a slave republic. No slaves come to his aid. He's captured. But what happens is the rhetorical effect of John Brown's raid. I mean, this guy is now considered a martyr. In fact, some people in the North are calling John Brown Jesus Christ. Well, if John Brown is Jesus Christ, as some suggested, what would happen to Southerners should the government fall into the hands of these people? I mean, if this guy is out there inciting slave rebellion, what's going to happen if somebody like John Brown gets into office at the federal level? Southerners are doomed then. I mean, they think what's going to happen is the government now will incite slave rebellion, and all these Southerners are going to be killed. This is how scared these people were in 1859 and 1860 about John Brown. And John Brown starts getting tremendous support in the North. And not everyone supported him in the North, but John Brown starts getting tremendous support. Again, this guy's like Jesus Christ. He's a martyr. This is a guy that everyone should support. I mean, when the day John Brown dies, it's just going to be a day of solemn remembrance for this great hero of the cause of anti-slavery. The guy was a nutcase. And people saw him like that. A lot of people did see him. Of course, in the South, they see him that way. There were Northerners that saw him that way, too. In fact, initially, John Brown was seen as a nutcase in the North. And they tried to distance, Northerners tried to distance themselves. But as this guy gets put on trial, and he has now a megaphone, so to speak, for pushing what he believes, and this stuff starts getting printed in the press, well, people start to become fairly sympathetic. He's a great self-promoter. And that's what he's going to do over and over again in prison, is self-promote. I'm this, I'm that. He's a homicidal maniac. That's what he'd always been. But now, of course, he's seen as a martyr. And that is scary for Southerners. They don't think they can have this. If they have this, they're in trouble. And it's also in 1859, as John Brown's put on trial and executed, you have William H. Seward saying again, we've got an irrepressible conflict. Very similar to Lincoln's speech, but he goes again one step further. Basically, he's saying we have to make the United States all free. We have to make it all free. He's already had his higher law speech where he had that same position. But now he's saying there's an irrepressible conflict. We cannot stop this. We're going to have war. We're going to have war. And this is going to be the guy that's Secretary of State. Now, Seward is often seen as Secretary of State as kind of this conservative guy trying to save the Union. And he was doing that as Secretary of State, trying to court Upper South Unionists. But here before the 1860 election rolls around, this guy is seen as a fanatic. Again, he was the front runner for the Republican Party for a time, William H. Seward. There was fear among Southerners. This guy will get the nod by the Republicans in 1860, and then they've got John Brown in the White House, a guy that's supporting John Brown. So, my gosh, what are they going to do? I mean, I think that it's hard for us to understand because, again, we have an abhorrence for slavery in the United States today. We don't understand how people could be so fervently defending an institution like that. But at the same time, this is their personal security they're concerned about here. You've got a guy that has killed people in Kansas, has tried to have a slave rebellion. You've got Northerners calling him Jesus Christ. You've got, or comparing him to Jesus Christ, essentially, his death to this martyrdom. You've got people, you know, holding solemn vigils over the death of this guy. What is going to happen when these people take over the government? And there was a very good chance that they could do that eventually. I mean, the South doesn't have enough electoral college votes to stop it. If the North decides it's going to vote as one and not vote for a Southern candidate or somebody that supports the South, that could really happen. You have to understand their personal security is at risk here. If John Brown is correct and people that support him are the majority in the North, which again was uncertain, are there going to be slave rebellions in the South? Are Southerners going to be, I mean, we've had some pretty serious slave rebellions. We had the Nat Turner Rebellion in the 1830s, which resulted in a number of deaths. Of course, that's when ultimately the slave codes would be further enforced in the South. But we've had that in the 1830s. I mean, that's not too far in the distance. That's 20 years before that there in Virginia. Is that going to happen again? Are we going to have a number of Nat Turners in the South now because you've got these people in the North that are saying Southerners essentially are evil with horns sticking out of their heads? And then we need to do something about it. We've got martyrs, abolitionist martyrs. I mean, what is going to happen here? This is scary stuff. So that when 1860 rolls around, this is the situation we're looking at here. The 1860 election is going to be such an interesting election because Southerners are at this point finally saying, enough is enough. If we can't win this election, we're done and we're out of here. And the way that election plays out is a very, very important, again, for the future of the United States, for the immediate future of the United States, because it's going to lead to war, but then the long-term future of the United States as well, because what's going to happen from that point forward really is the recreation of the United States. When we start talking about the war, I'm going to do secession in the next presentation. I'll do a presentation on the war itself, and then I'll start talking about Reconstruction. And I'm actually going to go into the war for Reconstruction. Most people don't do that. They consider Reconstruction kind of the after period, but Reconstruction really begins when the war begins in so many ways. Okay, so I will see you next time for our next presentation. We'll pick up with the 1860 election. We'll talk about secession, the formation of the Confederate States, and that's an interesting topic in and of itself. And we'll talk about how the war actually comes about.